Good morning, and welcome to the first edition of Inquisitive Minds, a new show on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each Wednesday morning at this time, we'll explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and staff, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On our first show, we hear about a statistical model developed by a Brock professor to determine the risk factor involved in cancer diagnoses. We'll talk with the co-author and editor of a new book to be launched this evening that examines the unique characteristics of public sector unionism in a Canadian context. And we'll talk to Brock's bullying expert about the fallout from that Frosh Week chant at St. Mary's University in Halifax, caught on video for the world to see. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Our first interview deals with a fascinating topic. This past weekend, Terry Fox runs were held across the country, as they have been for 33 years now, raising money for cancer research. Recently, some of that Canadian cancer research paid off in a big way with a local connection. Brock University epidemiologist Martin Temamagi was part of a cross-Canada study spearheaded by the BC-based Terry Fox Research Institute that should reduce the trauma experienced by cancer patients. Temamagi has developed a statistical model that depicts and predicts with high accuracy whether or not a nodule that shows up on a low-dose computed tomography lung scan has a high probability of being cancerous. Details of the model are contained in the study Probability of Cancer in Pulmonary Nodules Detected on First Screening Computed Tomography, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, September the 5th. Martin Temamagi joined us in the studio to discuss his model and the study. What did you first set out to accomplish when you developed the model?
Lung cancer for a long time has seen very little improvement in terms of survival, and in recent years we've made our first big remarkable headways in finding that we can improve mortality and reduce lung cancer deaths by screening for lung cancer with computed tomography. Now, computed tomography of high-risk individuals is going to lead to a lot of nodules being identified. And in fact, in high-risk individuals, we see about 20 to 25% nodules. And 98% of these are benign. And so that we wanted to have a model that would identify which ones were benign and which ones were truly cancer. And this was with the hope of reducing excessive testing, excessive biopsies, and surgical resections in individuals that were at low risk that didn't truly have a lung cancer. And on the other hand, if they did have a high-risk nodule, then they would receive immediate follow-up and immediate treatment. And this would hopefully improve their chances of survival so that it has many-fold advantages or purposes.
The tests that people have to undergo to determine whether they indeed have cancer, it's a real problem for them. There's a lot of anxiety involved. There's a lot that they have to go through. So by helping to reduce the probability of them going through these tests, I would think that's a real bonus for the patient to reduce their anxiety level and the time factor involved in finding out what the situation is.
Hopefully this will improve the time factor, the cost, the stress, not only for the patient, but also for their family, and so that it should improve the quality of life and reduce some of the uncertainty. And instead of the doctor telling them, we don't know what the real risk is, they can get something more definitive and more accurate as well.
So take me through the process here. What is going on when you use the model? How does it work?
The model was based on a study of over around 12,000 nodules in about 3,000 individuals. 144 of those nodules were cancer. We followed these individuals and these nodules up individually for about 3 years. We collected the data on the individuals and the nodules and then followed them up to see which ones were truly cancer. I plugged this information into a mathematical model and then found that we could discriminate which ones nodules were cancer and which ones were not. And we validated this model in new data, and it was quite accurate. And so that then the model was rather complicated to use mathematically for physicians and clinicians, so I put it into an Excel spreadsheet calculator. This calculator now is fairly simple to use. You have about 9 different variables that you have to enter into the calculator, and it instantaneously, within seconds, will give you the probability that a nodule is cancer. And in practice, that would be how you would use it.
So it doesn't take terribly long using the model to determine that, then?
Not at all. All of the heavy lifting has already been done for the physician. For them to use it is a simple matter of just collecting the data. Even a nurse can do this and just enter it into the spreadsheet and come up with the probability.
Now that the model is out there and it's basically being used in the real world, are you getting feedback from some of the doctors and medical staff who are using the model? And what are they saying?
I've gotten a lot of people emailing me thanking me for producing the model. The New England Journal of Medicine article was published last Thursday. Since that time, we've had over 500 downloads of the calculator from about 40 countries around the world. So it has received widespread interest, but it's early to tell how they like it and how well it's going to be received. One of the comments that I have had is that they can't take the laptop into the clinic with them and walk around with a laptop doing these calculations. Could I make an app out of it and put it into a smartphone? So we are definitely planning on doing that. In the meantime, I had one doctor contact me saying that he, on his Android, had Excel spreadsheet, and I needed to adapt the package, the calculator, a little bit so he could use it, but he successfully used it on the Excel spreadsheet on his Android phone, and he was quite happy about that.
Now, I know that in a lot of medical situations now, doctors and other medical personnel are using an iPad. Would it be doable, possible, that you would be able to develop it to be used on an iPad so that they wouldn't need the laptop?
Yes, that is possible. In fact, the British Columbia group that I'm working with, Dr. Stephen Lamb, his group already has adapted it as an app and are using it in their clinics as an iPad app and found it quite successful. It hasn't been commercialized for widespread sale, and that's one of the things I'm reluctant to do. I don't want to make this a commercial product. I didn't want this to be a money-making venture. It should be freely available to all clinicians and researchers. But that is the bottom line is that, yes, the iPad app is a good idea.
I would imagine, in addition to saving time and saving the discomfort for the patient, it's got to have some kind of a financial impact on the health system. Is this going to save the health system money?
It should save the money in that it should help detect individuals with lung cancer earlier, making their survival better. And often the cost of lung cancer care is highest in the terminal high stage individuals that need a lot of chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and hospitalization. But also it should reduce the number of expensive tests, the number of biopsies, the number of resections. And so that, yes, it should save the healthcare money.
I was reading where when you see the nodule, it can be solid, it can be semi-solid, or it can resemble, for want of a better expression, broken glass. What do those three indications tell you using the model about what you're finding? In other words, what is it telling you is there?
The appearance of the nodule can be ground glass, which is semi-transparent, or solid, which is you can't see through it at all, or a mixture of both. And the ground glass have a reduced risk of being cancer, whereas the semi-solid that are a mixture of both have an elevated risk of being cancer compared to a solid nodule. So that you get information from that. But you mentioned a broken glass look. This sometimes talks about the boundary or edge of the nodule and is called spiculation. Spiculation really refers to the nodule nodule having a kind of a sharp, jagged edges. And this does increase the risk of the nodule being cancer by quite a bit.
To me, as a layman, hearing that, does it mean that it's more painful for the patient having it in that form? Or is that just the appearance of it?
That's just the appearance. In terms of any pain associated with the nodule type, that is, there's no correlation between the appearance of the nodule and pain that I'm aware of.
Okay, so what are the odds the nodule found on the lung is going to be cancerous?
Well, it can range. Let me talk in terms of probabilities. The probability for a very tiny nodule that was the size of, say, 2 or 3 millimeters might be 1 in 10,000, whereas the probability of a nodule that was, say, 2.5 centimeters in size might be 40%, so that it can range considerably, and that's what the model tells you. You plug in all the information about the different parameters of the model, the age of the individual, the sex of the individual, history of emphysema, family history of lung cancer, then there's several features of the nodule that you have to enter into the model, the size of the nodule, the location in upper chest or not, the jaggedness or spiculation of it, and even the nodule count, how many nodules an individual has on the scan, is useful information in predicting what the probability is, but it can have a considerable range.
The accuracy rate you were talking about, over 90%, which is phenomenal. Can you improve on that, or is this basically as good as it gets?
The classification can be improved further, and this would take new studies with new information, new data, and we're always looking for new information, for example, biomarkers. Can we take a blood sample, take a measure of certain proteins in the body that might be a predictor of cancer, and can we add that into the model? We've done some preliminary investigation with a new biomarker, and we've had some positive results, and so that might be an improvement. And also, even though we had very high accuracy rates with this model in our test populations, in our validation population, if we applied this in a Chinese population or an Indian population, we might find that it doesn't work so well, so that we might need to change or modify the model for those populations or different populations. And science is always advancing and always improving over time, so that if we conducted new, large prospective studies and followed individuals up over time, then we might improve the model further. And also, technology is changing very quickly. Imaging is changing from X-ray to computed tomography to magnetic resonance imaging machines, and so that probably in 10 years' time, many of the things that we're doing now will already be obsolete. So I do expect improvements, yes.
Does the size of the nodule affect the accuracy rate?
Yes, it does. It's easy to predict that a very large nodule is going to be cancer, but it's much more difficult to evaluate a small nodule, a nodule that is 1 centimeter or 10 millimeters or less. And clinicians, radiologists, most often see the small nodules and are in a dilemma as to how to handle them and what to do. The nice thing is that the prediction model that we have has over 80% accuracy, even for nodules that are less than 1 centimeter. So that even for small nodules, it has relatively good accuracy, although not as good as for the bigger nodules.
We're talking with Martin Temamagi, epidemiologist at Brock University, about his model that has been developed for cancer research, which was developed as part of a cross-Canada study. Now, how many people were involved?
The study that really drove this model was the Pan-Canadian Early Detection of Lung Cancer Study, and it has 8 different centers across Canada, ranging from British Columbia to Halifax and Newfoundland. And in each center, we were trying to look at how can we screen individuals using computed tomography to detect lung cancer earlier, to institute treatment earlier, to save lives and improve survival. And so that we had many different centers collecting data, so that there are many, many people involved, radiologists, study managers, coordinators. And that study, the Pan-Canadian study, enrolled 2,537 individuals. That takes a lot of work, so there's a big team effort. I'm the epidemiologist and analyst on that study, and so that I get a lot of the data coming my way, and I do a lot of the analyses. In terms of this particular study, Everybody else had a part to play in collecting the data, and so that there's a lot of radiologists doing the imaging and interpreting the images. I collected the data, the epidemiological data, the imaging data, and then I put it into the model and developed the model. Now, I'm really just one part of a team, because once I built the model, I don't really get to use it. I don't get to interpret it. I give it back to the clinicians, and the clinicians and the practitioners, they're the ones who implement it and interpret it. And so that I'm one piece of the chain. Well, okay. A helpful one, yes.
So how many patients would have been involved in the study, or do we even have a number?
Well, we have a number of that participated in the study, and that's roughly 3,000 individuals were in the study. And in terms of nodules, we looked at roughly a little over 12,000 nodules and 144 cancers.
This is not your first cancer-detecting model, is it?
No. In fact, the first model that I developed was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in February. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it predicts which individual will develop cancer. And right now, because lung screening is looking like it's going to become a public health accepted phenomenon, we have to identify who should be screened for lung cancer. And that means that we need to screen high-risk individuals. My initial model identifies who those high-risk individuals are, and that model has also received a fair bit of attention. It's been downloaded from the Broad website almost 1,000 times now.
Wow.
Since February.
So they work hand-in-hand, essentially.
They work hand-in-hand. One tells you who should you screen to find out if they have cancer, and then once you screen them and you find out that they have a nodule, the second model tells you which nodule is actually cancer.
So do you have any other models you're working on, or this is it?
No, there's always work to be done. One thing we want to identify is a model that will identify cancer in never smokers. And surprisingly, there's a fair number of cancers in never smokers. We don't really know why they have it, but I'm working on a model that will identify that. Occupational exposures are important. I'm working on a model that will also evaluate asbestos and how it increases risk, and putting that into the model so we can have another model that we apply to occupational and environmentally exposed individuals. And another thing that I'm doing is many of the models that I've built so far, I've used information that's available in the literature and that we know already to be true, and I plug that into the models, and so it makes sense that these models are going to work. In the last 20 years, artificial intelligence has made rapid advances, and particularly in the last 10 years. So I'm working with some artificial intelligence methodologies to see if an artificial intelligence, a computer, can outperform me in terms of prediction modeling. And so far, I've been having a little bit of fun experimenting with that, and we're neck and neck, so that we're pretty close.
Now, the Canadian Cancer Society estimates on average 70 Canadians will be diagnosed with lung cancer every day, an average of 55 Canadians dying from lung cancer every day. So it must make you feel good about the research you and your team members are doing, that you really are going to have a positive impact on such a large section of the population.
It is nice to see that, and to put those numbers in a different way, 20,000 Canadians will die of lung cancer each year, and that's the leading cause of cancer death in Canada, in the United States, and in the world. Globally, 1.4 million people die of lung cancer each year, and so that it is the leading cause of cancer death in the world, and so it is a huge problem, and to be able to help out, it's a very satisfying feeling.
But having said that, do you think it's realistic to hope that cancer in general, and lung cancer in particular, could be significantly reduced or even, shall we say, eradicated at some point in the future?
No, I don't think that's realistic. Our population is aging. Cancer in many ways is a disease of the aged. And so I don't think it's realistic to expect that cancer will be cured. And many of the modern treatments that we've developed and spent billions of dollars on have only made tiny little incremental improvements, so that even though we're in many ways winning the war on cancer, we're never going to defeat cancer completely in the next 20 years, at least, I don't think.
But knowledge is power in the meantime.
Knowledge is power, and certainly the survival rates in cancer patients have improved considerably, very significantly over the last 40 years, so that we are making progress in many ways. And prevention is key. The one recommendation I have for individuals is that you don't try smoking, don't take up smoking, and definitely if you smoke, make every attempt to quit smoking. The smoking by itself accounts for an awful lot of cancers and other diseases as well, and so that by itself will have a huge impact on public health.
But what about secondhand smoke? Does that play into this at all?
Secondhand smoke is a risk factor for lung cancer. Fortunately, regulations have reduced the public health exposure to secondhand smoke considerably over the last 20 years, and so it's not a very big factor at all. And in terms of my models, they usually apply to smokers or people who have had current smoking or former smoking, and reducing or looking at the secondhand smoke in them, it's so small an effect compared to the actual firsthand smoke that it gets washed out, so that it doesn't play a big, it's not a big factor.
This is fascinating news. Thank you for your time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
That was Brock University epidemiologist Martin Temamagi discussing his statistical model that predicts accurately whether or not a nodule has a high probability of being cancerous. This is Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. Public sector unions in Canada have been plagued by all sorts of problems for decades now. Austerity, privatization, taxpayer backlash, and restrictions on union rights. In recent years, the intensity of state-led attacks against public sector workers has escalated to the point where many now question the role of public sector unions in protecting their members and the broader public interest. A new book will be launched this evening at the Niagara Artists Center in downtown St. Catharines that examines the unique characteristics of public sector unionism in a Canadian context. Its title is Public Sector Unions in the Age of Austerity, and includes contributions from several authors that explore both the strategic possibilities and the challenges facing public sector unions that appear intent on not only resisting austerity, but also enhancing their power base, if you will. Co-authors and editors of the book are Stephanie Ross, an associate professor and coordinator of the Work and Labor Studies program in the Department of Social Science at York University in Toronto, and Larry Savage, an associate professor of political science and labor studies at Brock University. Professor Savage joined us in the studio this week, and I asked him about the role of public sector unions in society today. Are they still relevant?
Well, I think public sector unions are probably more relevant than ever before. I mean, they're the face of a changing labor movement in Canada. I think when people think about unions, they still think of industrial, hard-hatted male worker, when in fact, the typical union member in Canada today is a woman, and she's more likely to work in the public sector.
Do you think they get a bad rap in the media that suggests they're maybe a little out of touch with the economic reality we now face?
I do think that public sector unions do face those sorts of challenges. I think that public sector unions are more prone to what we would call class envy arguments. And so it's this idea that you could have a cleaner, for example, who works in the private sector making minimum wage and has no benefit entitlements or pension might have some resentment towards a unionized cleaner who might work in a public institution, makes $20 an hour, and has access to pension and benefits. The question is the public sector worker who's unionized really the enemy here, or are there larger questions at stake? I think public sector unions are probably more relevant than ever before. I mean, they're the face of a changing labor movement in Canada. I think when people think about unions, they still think of industrial, hard-hatted male worker, when in fact, the typical union member in Canada today is a woman, and she's more likely to work in the public sector.
Do you think they get a bad rap in the media that suggests they're maybe a little out of touch with the economic reality we now face?
I do think that public sector unions do face those sorts of challenges. I think that public sector unions are more prone to what we would call class envy arguments. And so it's this idea that you could have a cleaner, for example, who works in the private sector making minimum wage and has no benefit entitlements or pension might have some resentment towards a unionized cleaner who might work in a public institution, makes $20 an hour, and has access to pension and benefits. The question is the public sector worker who's unionized really the enemy here, or are there larger questions at stake? That's one of the central themes in the book. And so I think that we need to say that public sector unions help us ensure that we don't have a race to the bottom where everyone's competing to make poverty wages, because communities and society couldn't work effectively if we were all trying to push to get down to the very bottom of the barrel.
I think part of the public perception of public sector unions is they seem to be a little out of touch, and sometimes the unions appear to be their own worst enemies.
Well, I think when it comes to strikes in the public sector, the dynamic is very different. So in the private sector, a union might go on strike against a private company that's making billions of dollars in profit but just doesn't want to share any of that profit with the workers. Public sector, of course, is different because the employer is the state, and by extension, the employer becomes taxpayers. And so that's where we see taxpayer backlash play a big role. But I think what we need to decide as a society is, if the employer is the state, does the state not have some obligation to employ people at living wages? Or should the state act like the greedy capitalist who tries to extract all sorts of work for the least amount of pay possible? I think that as a society, we have to make a decision about what sort of model that we want. And that's why I think public sector unions have grown, precisely because public sector employers wanted more and more to act like private sector employers, when in fact the public sector is a very different beast.
They've been at odds for so long. Do you think there will come a time when they will reconcile?
I think that unions actually do a lot to improve labor relations in workplaces. I think what we don't see in non-unionized workplaces is that there's all sorts of conflict. There's just not a mechanism for regulating it through a contract or a collective agreement process. But we shouldn't kid ourselves. Of course, there's conflict in non-union workplaces. If anything, I would say that unions and collective agreements that are negotiated help to create processes that are fair and just for all parties involved.
I think part of the problem with a public sector union, their boss being, generally speaking, the government, it's a much more public process. It's a much more open process. We see what's going on, whereas with a private corporation, it may not be as visible to the public, unless, of course, there's a great big full-blown strike underway.
Well, I think the reason public sector disputes are so much more visible, it's because the services that are affected by public sector strikes hit people at home. If a cereal-making factory, for example, went on strike, you know, you'd have a couple people upset who they couldn't get their favorite cereal. But, of course, that's not a life-and-death situation. If daycare workers or teachers or nurses went on strike, that would affect a far broader range. And we can't dismiss that when the public and disadvantaged groups rely on public services disproportionately, that they can get upset about these disruptions. And so public sector unions as social movement or political actors, I think, really need to rethink their strategy in terms of how they engage in labor disputes and engage with the public to communicate their message about why the dispute is happening in the first place. Because if the unions are pitted against the disadvantages groups that they serve, they're not going to get ahead strategically. They're not going to get the support they need to convince the employer or the state or the government to actually improve public services, which should be the goal.
Part of the problem, I think, would be perhaps they're using the old school methods that may have worked in the past, but for a new age, a more modern society, they don't necessarily work. So it may ultimately work against them to get their message out there to the public.
Well, I don't know if it's a question of old school versus new school methods, because, of course, unions and employers have always used a host of different methods in every historical period, from strikes, but through mediation and conciliation, through direct action and protest. And in some periods, some of these strategies have advanced the goals of public sector unions, and in other periods, those strategies have hurt public sector unions. I think the key here is for public sector unions to reach out to community organizations to talk about a common dialogue about what kind of public sector they want to see. Because unionized workers have tremendous power in shaping what their workplaces look like and what their service levels look like. So if a public sector union, for example, wanted to gear transit services around an overall goal of making transit use free for workers, that sort of demand would help garner lots of public support versus a union, for example, who might say, we just want to protect our pension plan. We're not interested in level of services.
Okay, now looking in recent memory, an ongoing labor disruption, the one last winter with the teachers union would be one that would come to mind that reinforced perhaps a public perception that they may be out of touch with the grassroots level. How do you look at what happened last winter and how it all played out in the media between both sides?
Yeah, I do think that the provincial government put those specific teachers' unions in a pretty difficult position last winter, in that they essentially were legislating away their collective bargaining rights. And so when a government takes such a heavy hand and intervenes in such a way, it leaves the unions involved with little room to maneuver. And so I think those unions felt like they were in a corner and what they needed to do was essentially withdraw extracurricular activities as a form of protest towards the government. Now, of course, that strategy is going to annoy parents and students who rely on these extracurricular activities. And that's why I think you saw some of those teachers' unions instead take to the street, use direct action, participate in elections. There was a very high-profile by-election in Kitchener where teachers' unions helped defeat the Liberal candidate. And so I think they've done more than just those direct actions in the workplace. But as we've seen, that issue became smoothed out. It is unclear, though, what it will do between the relationship with teachers and politicians in the years to come. I suspect that teachers' unions are going to have to think really hard about the utility of using the strike weapon when using the strike weapon puts at a disadvantage the very public that they serve. This is going to be a huge problem for all public sector unions moving forward, but I think there are some creative alliances that can be created around demanding better public services as a way of bringing teachers, students, and parents together.
They were really between a rock and a hard place as far as taking the extracurricular activities away from the students. They couldn't win. Is that a strategy that, on their part, they're going to have to rethink in the future?
I mean, I'm not here to provide advice to these teachers' unions. They're democratic organizations that will be controlled by their members, and their members will tell them what they want to do. What I will say, though, is that I think public sector unions, including those teachers' unions, need to think long-term about the strategies that they employ. Because pointing fingers at school boards when, in fact, the provincial government is really in control of the budget makes it a difficult political game on various different levels. And again, I think it's the commitment to serving the public service levels, if those can be integrated into the demands of the union, they'll have a much better time bringing people on board so that in the cases where they have to go on strike, they will have a built-in support network that will be working to pressure the government on those issues.
We're talking with Larry Savage, who has co-authored and edited a book titled Public Sector Unions in the Age of Austerity, which will be launched this evening at 7 o'clock at the Niagara Artists Center in downtown St. Catharines. In regards to the other public sector unions in Canada, what do we see on the horizon for them here on in?
Well, the public sector union membership in Canada is very diverse. So it includes everything from nurses to police officers, firefighters, janitors at universities, teachers and university professors. And so the public sector is very diverse. And so I don't think that there's one single path that all of them are going to go down. There are some commonalities, though, and I think that two that I've highlighted and I'd like to talk about again are this idea of how public sector unions deal with taxpayer backlash. So I think in the Niagara region, for example, when the police association won pay raises through arbitration, that there was some public anger directed towards them. We also see pressure across the board to ask public sector workers to take zeros in terms of wage increases, when the same thing is not happening in the private sector, but we are seeing private sector job loss. Again, I think it goes back to this point that taxpayers, of course, they want value for their money. Do they want to be paying poverty wages that then force people to rely more and more on public services? It's like a dangerous spiral. I think that public sector unions have to assert their power, again, through combinations of alliances with community organizations. And so these things are mutually reinforcing. That it's not just about wages and salaries in the public sector, because many public sector workers got into the public sector because they want to serve the public. And so they're very interested in service levels. And if they can make their bargaining demands about ensuring that those service levels are high, they can build a stronger rapport with the publics that they serve.
As far as the taxpayer backlash is concerned, obviously they want value for their money. But there comes a point where you can't go with the savings alone, because it comes down to you get what you pay for. You have to pay for the services that they're offering. It's getting that message out to the taxpayers that they are indeed getting value for the money with those wages that are being paid.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. And again, I think we live in an era of lowered expectations, right? We don't expect that anyone should be able to get a job with a pension anymore. And that's simply a wrong way of thinking, that there's tremendous wealth in this country. It's the way that the wealth is distributed that's the problem. So, of course, there's this huge and growing gap between the super wealthy in North America and the rest of society. And until we deal with those larger structural inequalities, these sorts of questions, even though they're top of mind for plenty of people, are really secondary.
Do you think public sector unions in Canada will survive as we know them?
I think so. I think that whether they're in a different form is another question altogether, but unions will always be with us as long as we work in capitalist economies, because I think that conflict is inherent in any sort of employment relationship. And workers recognize that individually their ability to confront or to challenge management is not nearly as strong as when workers speak collectively with one voice.
Larry Savage, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
That was Larry Savage, Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Labor Studies at Brock, and discussing public sector unions in Canada as he prepares to launch a new book he has co-edited and co-authored with Stephanie Ross from York University in Toronto. The book is entitled Public Sector Unions in the Age of Austerity, available from Fernwood Publishing. The public is invited to the book launch this evening at 7 at the Niagara Artists Centre in downtown St. Catharines. We all saw the footage a couple of weeks ago from Halifax and the small university there with a big international reputation, St. Mary's. There on the screen for everyone to see were student politicians leading a chant about underage non-consensual sex during an orientation week event. The chant's phrasing was based on the word young, and we don't need to go into the details here other than to say it was pretty embarrassing for the university as well as everyone else in Canada. The university president since 2000, Dr. Colin Dodds, sprang into action just hours after finding out about the incident and immediately issued a statement taking full responsibility for the event and apologizing unreservedly. He also struck a task force in order to deal with the problem. But is that enough? It's believed the chant has been used at Frosh Weeks since at least 2009. How could it be allowed to go on that long without anyone taking notice until now? And now we have reports of a similar chant being performed by students at the University of British Columbia as well. So one asks the question, is there a culture of violence against women, possibly, at some Canadian universities? Brock University bullying expert Tony Volk joined us in the studio, and I asked him his first reaction when he heard the news and saw the footage from St. Mary's University.
I thought that I had stepped in a bit of a time machine. It was really surprising to hear those kinds of comments coming from students in 2013.
I know there was an incident at University of British Columbia that was reported after the fact. Is this something that has been known to happen at other universities in the country?
Certainly in the past, it's been known to happen. As people became more politically sensitive and aware of the meaning and intent of their words, more and more focus has been placed on being more sensitive in how you're presenting things. It's one thing to be jubilant and excited about coming into university, but there's lines that you can't cross.
Now, considering the number of international students attending universities, for example, on a yearly basis, could we attribute this in any way to a cultural divide between Canada and other countries?
If anything, I'd go the opposite, and I'd suggest this is more suggestive of past Canadian culture, the idea of hazing and having rituals associated with fraternities. That kind of group mentality that exists in North America is, I think, more explanatory than what we might see from students coming from abroad.
Looking specifically at St. Mary's, that incident, have they reacted to the problem in a proper fashion, or really do they need to do more?
Well, it's difficult to say with certainty at this point. Certainly they showed a very strong initial response, and that was very satisfactory. You want them to show a strong expression of outrage. Now, whether they're actually going to do anything about it in the future, both the student union as well as the university administration, remains to be seen.
The university president was quoted as saying that he's taken immediate action to deal with the problem, but apparently this had happened at Frosh Week since at least 2009. I personally find that hard to believe, that no one said or did anything about it prior to this.
You know, that's a good point, and it's not unknown for Canadian universities to try and cover up some of the wrongdoings of their students. Queen's tried to cover it up for years, for example, of their Frosh Week and homecoming party, until eventually it got out of control and somebody was seriously injured. I don't remember if they might have even passed away. And at that point, you couldn't hide it anymore. It couldn't be something swept under the rug. And I think that's what happened now in this era of the internet. It couldn't be swept under the rug.
So as far as Brock University is concerned, what measures do we have in place to prevent such an occurrence here at Brock University?
Well, we have a strong student union who focuses on including diversity as part of their message. So these kinds of slogans that are established at some of the older universities are not as prevalent at Brock University, those sentiments. As well, we have tight policies on equal respect and human language.
We're talking with Tony Volk, the Brock University bullying expert, about the fallout from the St. Mary's University Frosh Week chant down in Halifax that happened a couple of weeks ago. Does what we saw there constitute bullying in your mind?
Well, it depends. It depends if it was targeted at individuals and if individuals received it as a threatening message. If they did, then it certainly would constitute as bullying. Essentially, it certainly was irresponsible and reckless, was offensive, and it bordered on, in some ways, criminal content if you're talking about taking advantage of underage individuals. Whether the people who were part of that perceived it as a threat has not been brought to light.
So let's talk about bullying in general then. What is bullying, and what should, as a society, we be doing about it?
Well, something about bullying is that it's tricky to define. And we're actually looking at that right now at Brock University. It's one of the lines of research we're working on, is figuring out what is and isn't bullying. I think some of the main things that define it is, first of all, there has to be a power imbalance. This is when you have individuals who are competing and one of them can't successfully fight back, whether it's physically, socially, over the internet. They just can't mount a charge backwards. The other characteristic is that it has to cause harm, and it has to be something that's driven by goals, so it shows some kind of intent. It's not accidental.
For a lot of us growing up, bullying usually involved physical or verbal abuse in the schoolyard. But these days, it's a lot more complicated than that. It's a lot more complex.
Yeah, one of the important things is that bullying can now travel over the internet. And this cyberbullying is a particularly insidious form of bullying in that it's permanent and it can reach an exponential audience, which is something that didn't exist as much in the past. The social bullying did exist in terms of attacking and sabotaging people's reputations. That's been going on for thousands of years. But the new thing about the internet is it's made it this permanent form of abuse, potentially.
The internet is really the culprit, as you say. Social media really comes into play here and has for the last few years. How should students handle cyberbullying if they encounter it?
Yeah, one of the main changes that we see today versus the past is that students are using technologies that their parents really, for the most part, aren't able to give them good advice on. In the past, parents could give you advice on how to deal with a social situation or physical bullying. It's something they've had experience with. Today, students are faced with navigating new technologies that adults tend to lag behind. So one of the key things that we see is being comfortable with these technologies, understanding their limits. So for example, knowing that if you post something online, it's permanent. Things that go online can spread very quickly. And then lastly, it's still important to have real-world relationships. We see that kids who are victimized on the internet, if they have strong real-world connections, it has less of an impact than if they don't.
Does it surprise you that cyberbullying is as pervasive a problem in this day and age as it is?
No, not at all. We've taken the approach that bullying is, again, a goal-directed, intentional behavior. And we know from our research, as well as research of other people across the globe, that bullies are not these slow, dim-witted, antisocial kids who can't get along. They're, for the most part, some fit that definition, but about 90% are the captains of the football team, the head of the cheerleaders, great social skills. They know what they're doing. They have goals to achieve. So when you give them a way of getting those goals almost for free, and that it's very difficult to track them down and punish them on the internet, it becomes a really attractive option. So unfortunately, I'm not surprised.
Are they aware in all cases that they are in fact bullying someone, or do they just think they're having fun and the other person is taking it too seriously?
They tend to underestimate the impact they have on their victim, especially when it's what we call bullying for status. You can bully for resources or dating opportunities. That's more direct, one-on-one. But when they bully in front of a group, they do tend to underestimate the impact that they're having. But if you sit them down and say, listen, in this situation, how do you expect this person would feel? They very quickly realize that, yes, this person would feel hurt in this context. So they report that they have less of an impact, but I think that's because they're blocking that out. They choose not to care about that.
Now, I know that for some people who would have been in school, myself included, long before social media would have been as all pervasive as it is in this day and age, might find it a little hard to believe that people can, in fact, be bullied online. That is a bit of a surprise, I suppose, to some people, that you just can't turn it off, go to another website, ignore it if you want. That doesn't seem to be an option for a lot of the younger people today who just can't seem to say, no, I choose not to go there, and I will turn it off.
Right. It's become part of their social environment. Just like you could say in the past, well, if they're bullying you in the cafeteria, don't go to the cafeteria at lunch. That's fine, but you want to see your friends. You want to be involved with other people. So similarly with the internet, if you're going to a site where all your friends or the other students at the school are going and you're now being prevented from going there because of the bullying, it's difficult for students to stay away. It's a tough choice.
If a student is being bullied and that person's friends are aware of it, what should they be doing?
Well, the first thing they should do is try and support their friend who is receiving the bullying. So offer them as much emotional support as you can. Emphasize that this is a problem with the bully, not the victim. This is not something they brought on themselves. And then if it continues, I would certainly recommend trying to find adult assistance. Whether it's at the university level or a high school level, you know, adults do have sanctions that they can bring to bear. And that's a very important thing because the bullies have chosen this individual because they can't fight back on their own. If they could, it wouldn't be a case of bullying. So that person needs help.
Is there a reluctance, though, for them to go to, for example, a guidance counselor, a trusted teacher, someone else at the university or the high school to let them know what's going on? There's this fear that if they tell that person, it could get worse.
Yeah, that's a valid concern. At one level, people don't like snitching. I think you have to decide if it's a serious case or not. And in most cases, actually, while people don't like a tattletale of somebody who keeps saying, oh, so-and-so is bumping my chair, that gets annoying. But somebody reports something serious, the vast majority of students back that up. And as far as retaliation goes, the person is already suffering from the bully. They're at the mercy of the bully, who doesn't have very much. So taking it to the next level is not likely to make things significantly worse than they already are.
So what advice would you give to a student in this day facing bullying? What is the first thing they should do?
The first thing I would do is say you're not alone. Recognize that this is not a problem because of you. You aren't the problem. The bully is the problem. You've had bad luck, essentially, in that a bully has chosen you as their victim. Find friends and family to support you. And if it doesn't resolve itself quickly, report it to an adult who's in a position to do something about it. Whether this is a teacher, a principal, a parent, somebody who you trust will do something about the problem.
You touched on the family there. How involved should the family be dealing with this problem?
Ideally, the family's role should be supportive. And in most local area schools, we have fairly strong principals who take a stand against bullying. But if, for example, we've seen in the case in the U.S. where the principals drag their feet, the Rita Parsons case seems to be a case where people were not very motivated out east. In those cases, then parents can become a really important advocate. So the individual who's being victimized doesn't have to be re-victimized by adults who say this is not a problem. The parents can step in and shoulder that burden.
Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Volk.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Tony Volk from the Department of Child and Youth Studies at Brock University, and he's Brock's bullying expert. It's interesting to note Professor Volk arrived at Brock when Facebook was in its infancy, and now Facebook and other social media that was spawned by Facebook is now an integral part of our lives today, and in some cases, a little too much so, it seems. Well, that's it for this first edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the inaugural show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Be kind. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. ¶¶